Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. The time is 1:35. Our recording secretary is Carrie. Thank you. And also our LIO operator is Ben. With me this afternoon is Vice Chair Senator Meyer and Senator Gardner.
Thank you.
We have two bills on the agenda today, House Bill 301, related to alcohol licenses, introduced by Representative Wohl, and he's here. Welcome. Following the introduction of that bill and public testimony on it, we will then move to House Bill 142, unemployment insurance benefits, and that's been introduced by Representative Tuck, who's here in the room. Thank you for being here. So with that, we will go ahead and have the introduction of House Bill 301. Welcome, Representative Wohl, and we'll go ahead and have you explain the bill and go through the sectional, take members' questions, and then we'll open it for public testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Adam Wohl, representative from District 5 in Fairbanks, and with me is Laura Steidoff, my legislative aide. And thank you again for allowing me to present HB 301, which I've been calling the Roadhouse Bill, which essentially would grandfather in about 34 businesses that currently have a kind of a liquor license. It's called the Tourism BDL. And this license was established in 1985. And prior to that, any establishment with 10 rooms or more could get a beverage dispensary license. And in 1985, they changed the definition and made the number of rooms contingent upon the size of the community that the business was in. So if you're in Anchorage, you needed 50 rooms. Different communities had different numbers, say, and Wasilla was different than Fairbanks, et cetera. But many businesses then had to have 40 or 50 rooms. And since 1985 until now, these licenses were consistently renewed and were deemed compliant. There was a regulations project in 2016 and legislative audit determined that these licenses were actually non-compliant because the law says you have to have, say, 40 rooms, and a lot of these businesses had 10 rooms. So they were told that they have to – a legislative fix was needed. And this was the board, the ABC board, had also determined that a legislative fix was needed. So a legislative fix is in front of you, and basically it says whatever number of rooms you had at the time that you got your license would be fixed. So if I opened a business with 10 rooms and then either the law changed or the population changed, I was still compliant with the amount of rooms that I had at the time of licensure. And some communities have grown significantly, the Matsu Valley in particular, and so instead of asking these businesses to build 20 or 30 or 40 more rooms, they were essentially grandfathered in. And that's essentially what this bill does, is allows the 34 businesses to stay open in operation. There are two other things that the bill does that we've added since the initial draft, and Laura Steidoff can go over those changes. And if you'd like to hear those now, that I'm available.
Yeah, if Laura could walk us through those changes.
Oh, you need the microphone, I guess.
Laura Steidoff, staff for Representative Wohl. In Section 1, we added, we amended AS 411-330A, which changed the annual operating hours requirement for license holders from 38-hour days to 240 hours.
Excuse me, Laura, could you repeat that?
We changed the annual operating hours requirement for a license holder. So the amount of hours that they must operate annually to maintain their license, rather than 38-hour days, it's just 240 hours total. And that was done because some businesses, bars, seasonal businesses, don't necessarily operate on an 8-hour day. And so as long as they have 240 hours, they will be able to maintain their license.
Okay. Thank you.
And the second change was done in Section 4, and it amends AS 411-491A, and we added an outdoor recreation lodge license to the licenses that may be approved by voters in a municipality on a local option ballot. And This was done, there was a couple of lodges in Bristol Bay that are in a local option area and have been operating since 2011. Their community did a ballot to opt them in to allow a liquor license, but then it was found in an audit that outdoor recreation lodge licenses could not be opted into. So this puts outdoor recreation lodge licenses into the licenses that may be opted into locally.
Thank you. So are there any questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for the sponsor, if not maybe Dale Fox or somebody can help me. How does this play in with the Title IV rewrite that's currently going on?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the last two changes we made in regards to the number of hours, the aggregate hours, was something that is actually in Title IV as written. So Title IV did have that change. This was sort of extracting it from Title IV to make it happen now. There was a representative from District 9 in Delta that had a business that was heavily affected by this and facing fines because they didn't stay open for eight-hour days. So, and the other change about adding the list, I'm not sure that was in Title IV, but it certainly could have been because it was sort of a cleanup. The list of opt-in types of licenses is fairly extensive, but outdoor lodges, recreational lodges, are not on the list. As far as the grandfathering in, that this probably would have been addressed in Title IV since all the other laws were gone over, but I'm not sure that that change was already incorporated into Title IV or not. My guess is they wanted a legislative fix for sure before then because Title IV is still in committee.
Sure. Okay. And then, Madam Chair?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. So this is only for those businesses pre-1985, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. For the most part, it is. There's a couple that were licensed after 1985 and were told they had to have, say, 10 or 20 rooms. And then since then, either the community changed or upon further inspection, the statute said that they had to have more. But because they got their license, there was one that got it in 1986. I think the Duck Inn was one. There's one or two that got a license right around that time, and we looked up the history of when they applied, and it was unclear. So we threw them into the 34.
Senator Meyer, a member of the Duck Inn is online to testify, so we can have them also address.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, though, these businesses that started after 1985, are they adversely impacted by this, or do they? What happens to them?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, any business starting after 1985 would have to comply with the law as it was at the time of licensure. So let's say I opened a tourism business and got a tourism BDL in 1990, and my requirement at the time was 20 rooms. And then in 2018, the population grew and my requirement was 40 rooms. I would still only have to have 20 rooms because that's what it was at the time of licensure.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We'll go ahead and start the public testimony. First, I'd like to invite Nancy Trump with Latitude 62 Lodge. Nancy, if you could provide your name for the committee and your testimony.
Yes, my name is Nancy Trump, and I own and operate Latitude 62 Lodge in Talkeetna.
Nancy, and if you want to go ahead and provide your public testimony.
Okay. My partner and I have owned and operated Latitude 62 Lodge and Motel in Talkeetna since May of 1986. We purchased it then from the previous owner who built it and built 10 rooms. We've added on 3 rooms since then. We've been open year-round since 1986. We only close for Christmas and Thanksgiving. We have 13 rooms, a bar, and a restaurant. Our liquor license is a very critical part of our operation. Without it, we would not be able to stay in business. Having said that, we are not just a bar. We are a full-service restaurant, a town meeting place, a full-service motel. In our business, we've hosted weddings, birthday parties, baby showers, celebration of life. We have Chamber of Commerce meetings there, FAA pilot meetings, and much, much more. We're across the street from the elementary school and are listed as a safe place if there is a need to evacuate the school. And our rooms are mostly full in the summer and not so full in the winter time. There's two other businesses in Talkeetna that are affected by this, and they probably have a total of 20 rooms each, and so you're looking at about, you know, 50 or 55 rooms in Talkeetna that would probably be shut down if we lost our liquor licenses. We employ 15 to 20 people year-round, which is significant to our town of 800. It would not be viable for us to stay in business if we do not have a liquor license. Also, someday, I'd like to retire, going on 32 years now, and I'd like to be able to sell the business with the license that we've worked very hard on keeping. So I'm here to ask you to please support House Bill 301 and grandfather us in with a tourism beverage dispensary license so we can continue to operate our business. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Nancy. Next, Debbie Carey calling in from Nanilchik.
Hi, my name is Debbie Carey. I own the Inlet Beer Bar and restaurant in Nanilchik, Alaska. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak before you today. There are currently beverage dispensary tourism licenses under review for not meeting room requirements. The loss of these licenses would have a huge economic impact on communities, families, and the state. I'm here to talk specifically about the licenses on the Kenai Peninsula Borough, which could potentially be negatively impacted through no fault of our own. When we purchased our license, we believe we met all legal requirements, mainly because we received our license, and in my case, I have continued to have my license renewed for the past 27 years. So let's take a moment and look at the facts and ask ourselves, is it reasonable to believe the intent of the law was to take the entire population of a borough the size of West Virginia, subtract the population of the cities, and apply that population figure to the rest of the establishments regardless of geographic location, actually requiring the rural areas outside city limits to maintain more rooms than the cities themselves? Or would it be more reasonable to believe in a borough the size of West Virginia that some sort of geographical filter would be applied? I'm asking the state for a permanent fix to this situation. None of us want to live in fear of losing our licenses or not being able to sell when it comes time to retire. As I said, I've been here for 28 years. There are many economic factors to also consider. The loss of jobs, the loss of license fees for the state. The current requirement would require me to have 40 rooms, which is four times the original amount, and I can guarantee you that my sales have not increased by four times what they were 27 years ago. The cost of complying with the new interpretation of the statutes would be cost prohibitive. To add an additional 30 rooms would require an investment of close to or more than $500,000. In the Nanilchik, the rooms around town are collectively full one weekend a year. That would be Salmon Fest weekend. I have guests that have been returning to this establishment for over 30 years. The feasibility of building an additional 30 rooms is impossible when you account for the land needed to engineer a water and sewer system, which would meet federal requirements. There would also be numerous social impacts to our communities. As the previous caller stated, we've held weddings, funerals, gatherings, celebrations, fundraisers. We do an annual Thanksgiving potluck. We're a communication center for tourists and the locals. We donate to many local causes, such as the school, the library, senior center, fairgrounds, etc. In closing, I'd like to point out on all of the Kenai Peninsula Borough licenses that are in question are all small mom-and-pop operations that have been around for a very long time and are the cornerstones of our community. Please help us continue to prosper within our communities and find a permanent solution to this situation. I urge you to support House Bill 301. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Linda Superman calling in from out of state. I won't say where because we won't be jealous of you.
Hi, this is Linda Superman. I own and operate the Hungry Hut Bar in Christie. And I have done so for the last 25 years. I inherited the bar from my mother. She ran the bar from 1972 to 93 when she passed away. The motel that existed there was a pretty rundown motel. So my husband and I, in 1997, through the approval of the ABC board, built a new tin room, which was approved as grandfathered in 1997. And we mortgaged our home to do that, still paying for that. I mean, if I was forced to build another 30 rooms, I don't know where I'd put them, number one, because of my two lot sizes. It would entail another septic system also. I pretty much agree with everything the last person's testimony, everything that she said, pretty much what I was going to say, so I won't, you know, keep you with that. I just hope that you all look out for our best interest when you take your vote, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Linda. Next, Pete Hansen with Alaska Char calling in from Anchorage.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pete Hansen, President and CEO of Alaska Char. First of all, let me say that the people who have testified have said some of the things I wanted to say. I appreciate their testimony. I want to indicate that Alaska Char is strongly supportive of House Bill 301. These are longstanding businesses that provide important services in their communities and to the traveling public. They provide jobs, they pay taxes, and because of some unintended ambiguity in the law from 1985, they are facing the prospect of having their licenses taken away and losing their businesses. Fixing that ambiguity and maintaining the original intent of this law is the right thing to do, so we ask you to support House Bill 301. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate you calling in. Next, Arden Rankins calling from Cooper Landing with the Sunrise Inn.
Hi, my name is Arden Rankins. I own the Sunrise Inn in Cooper Landing, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I'm in exactly the same boat and have basically exactly the same thing to say as everyone else. Cooper Landing has a population of about 275 to 300 people, and if this law was in effect and I had to build rooms to come up with the population, I would have to build 40 rooms, and that is 82 times larger population that I was grouped in with than the actual population of Cooper Landing. The Sunrise Inn was built in 54, got its liquor license in the early 60s, and is still in business to this day, year-round. I just bought the business in November of 15, put all of my retirement savings into it, and we're open year-round. So, again, like the other businesses, I would end up closing the day after I lost my liquor license, and that would negatively impact our schools. We're the only gathering place available in Cooper Landing. We're the only place open year-round between Girdwood, Sterling, and Seward, so we're a safety spot on what can be a very dangerous road. Again, I'm not going to reiterate all the other points that everyone made. Just know that it's very, very necessary for us to be able to maintain our businesses, not just for our personal gain, but for our communities and for safety reasons as well. So I appreciate the time to talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arden. Next, Lila Rosen calling in from Soldotna.
Hi. Is it okay to talk?
Yes. Please provide your name and testimony for the committee.
Okay. My name is Lila Rosen, and I'm testifying on House Bill 301, and I'm from the Duck Inn in Soldotna, Alaska. I would like to speak on behalf of our business, the Duck Inn, in regards to how the Title IV statute the BDL tourism license and reference how the interpretation made this year affects our business and our lives personally. We have lived in Alaska for over 38 years and have owned the duck for over 11 years, and it's safe to say that we are lifelong Alaskans who invested in Alaska and this business a very long time ago. Excuse me. The Duck is a small motel, cafe, and lounge purchased with a beverage dispensary tourism license that was transferred to us in 2007 and has renewed every odd year since then. Even though we've operated within the intent of the law, that license is now in jeopardy because of the interpretation that was made by the ABC board this year. The thought of having this investment in our future that we made so long ago stripped away is a very scary one. It will suffice to say that we feel bullied by this business decision. In our court system in Alaska and America, precedence is set, and that becomes new law. I feel that the AMOC board has set a precedence for our businesses by allowing our licenses to operate and transfer decades ago. It is frightening to think that 11-year investment in our license, and it could suddenly be deemed non-transferable without considerable expenditures and told we are now suddenly non-compliant. The threat to take away our alcohol license made me reflect on how much our small business has provided to our community and the state. It made me very proud of what we have achieved in the past 11 years. We have paid nearly $1 million to our community and state in tax revenue, contributed to over 200 local charities, fundraisers, and community events, donated rooms in the dead of winter for the homeless and sometimes families displaced from a fire or some other tragedy at no expense to the family. We provide full-time and part-time employment year-round for over 30 employees, not just during the busy summer months. We provide lodging for sports teams all winter and gathering place for tourists and locals alike. It's important for us to speak because we are the local residents of Alaska that are facing this noncompliance for an unrealistic change that is not feasible for us financially or dynamically. And taking away our ability to sell our business or transfer it with the license also threatens our economic future. Please be a friend in business and help us operate correctly with this solution. This is an opportunity for the government to be a government support system to our business and recharacterize the statute once and for all. It is our request today that you support House Bill 301 and be a friend to our businesses and to help us solidify a solution within the law that is amicable for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Leela. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify on House Bill 301? Go ahead and come forward, Dale.
Sit down here. So my name is Dale Fox, and I'd like to testify in favor of this correction. 33 years ago, I was one of the guys walking around the halls of the legislature promoting the bill that needs a correction. So for that, I'd like to say I'm sorry.
And Dale, are you representing Char this afternoon?
Yeah. Okay. I'll say I'm representing Char and maybe the Alaska Visitors Association from 33 years ago. Our intent 33 years ago was to promote tourism and give you a little history of how this happened. In territorial days, with 10 rooms, you could get a BDL because it was called a roadhouse license at the time. And that carried forward through the 60s and into the 70s. What happened in the 70s, we got a little pipeline, and people started building 10 rooms in order to get a beverage dispensary license. It was the afterthought was the rooms. And as a tourism promotion project, we wanted to see hotels built and our tourism industry grow. We weren't thinking about transfers. We weren't thinking about grandfathering. And frankly, nobody else was either, because for the last 33 years, every exec, every board, every staff of the ABC has looked at this and said, common sense says that wasn't the intent to kick the license out from underneath these hardworking families that you're hearing from. And it's not just the 34 business owners that get hurt if we don't fix this, but it's all of their employees and their community. So for that, I'd like to say my apologies for not thinking of that 33 years ago when I was promoting this bill. That needs correction now. But also, to on behalf of those folks, we need to do this. It's the only decent thing to do. I encourage you to pass HB 301.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else? Yes. So Lynn Cardew, if you wanted to come forward, welcome. The City of Wasilla.
For the record, Lynn Carden, Deputy Administrator for the City of Wasilla. City of Wasilla is in support of HB 301. We have two businesses affected in our community inside the City of Wasilla, but our bigger community, which the City of Wasilla is the downtown for the Mat-Su Borough, has several licenses also affected. We support this legislative fix as we support everybody who's testified on the phone so far. Economically, this makes sense. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify on the bill? Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Did want to mention to the members that Erica McConnell, the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, has been online listening to the testimony. Do members have any questions for her? Senator Gardner.
Madam Chair, I don't actually have a question, but I'd just like to point out to members that there is a letter of support from the ABC board in our documents.
Thank you very much. Okay. Any further questions from committee members? Okay, we'll go ahead and hold House Bill 301 and take a brief at ease as we get ready for the next bill. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next, we have House Bill 142, introduced by Representative Tuck, and you're here with your staff, Kendra Kloster. Welcome. So go ahead and introduce yourself and the bill, and maybe walk through a sectional, and then we'll go into public testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing House Bill 142, improvement to the unemployment insurance. With me is my Chief of Staff, Kendra Kloster. I'll have her do an opening statement, talk about the sections a little bit, and then I'll follow up with the economic benefits.
Great.
For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Tuck. A little brief introduction. The purpose of the unemployment insurance is to provide individuals and businesses with economic stability to help keep Alaskan dollars in the Alaskan economy. Unemployment benefits are offered through the Department of Labor through the Unemployment Insurance Program to eligible workers who become unemployed by no fault of their own. They must meet certain criteria in order to qualify for the UI benefits. Unemployment insurance can help reduce social and family consequences. With the high seasonal type of employment that we have here in Alaska, whether it's fishing, tourism, and of course with our construction season as well, some of this, the unemployment insurance can help bridge the gap for those families. A lot of times, you know, we're putting training, a lot of dollars into these individuals and building up their skills, and if they go through periods of not having proper unemployment insurance to help them bridge the gap, that they may be leaving the state, that taking with their experience with them and having to retrain other individuals would cost us even more money. And we have not updated our unemployment insurance benefits since 2009, so we are about dead last through 50 states, Puerto Rico, and D.C., and on our compensation benefits. So what House Bill 142 would do is increase the maximum weekly benefit payable under the state's UI system from the current $370 per week to $510. We also have, so that's that section, so going into the sectional a little bit then, so that will be section one. You're going to see, of course, a lot of numbers. It goes up by $2 if you're looking at the bill. And then section two, what you're looking at is rather than having to come back and update it every certain, you know, every few years, is we're putting a mechanism in there to increase those benefits automatically rather than having to continue to come back to the legislature
asking to do this every few years. As you know, of course, bills take a long time. It's hard, and we haven't passed it since 2009, so we just want to keep up with that so we can make sure our families are able to pay rent, their mortgage. We don't want them to lose their home in the time that they might be looking for other employment or waiting for another construction job to come along. So we just want to ensure that they're able to take care of their families during those tough times. You know, we've heard a lot of times of people saying this isn't the right time to increase these benefits, when actually we do, and this is why the bill is coming forward, is we believe that this is a good time to do that. You know, right now we might be in an economic downturn, so we need to help our Alaskans to ensure that they have funds to help pay the mortgage and put food on the table at this time. So this is an important bill, I think, to many individuals. We heard testimony in other committees where it was just, it's been hard for them in between and taking care of their families with some of these benefits being so low at this time. So we just bringing this forward to you now. We have Department of Labor folks here, Lennon Weller, I believe Ed Flanagan and Patsy Westcott is also here, all from Department of Labor, to help with any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Chris Tuck, serving District 23. Just want to talk about some of the economic benefits of having unemployment insurance, especially when you have a downward spiral in your economy. There's been a study done by the Columbia Business School, which is a world-class Ivy business school, that's titled The Importance of Unemployment Insurance as an Automatic Stabilizer. And what they're referring to as being an automatic stabilizer is really to the economy. This shows that unemployment insurance, as acting as an economic automatic stabilizer, the more generous the unemployment insurance benefits are, the better the region fares overall. And research explains that as demand for products and services decline due to unemployment, unemployment insurance allows for continual cash flow in the community. And every dollar that is invested into unemployment insurance nationwide contributed to about 19,000 new jobs. And that research was done by the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of like our Ledge Affairs with Ledge Legal. It's a nonpartisan agency that serves to review the president's budget as well as looking into the Senate and the House as they start working with their budgets. But they also look at the economic benefits of any policies that Congress ever comes up with. And in that study, showing that the 19,000 jobs are created, they compared that to any dollar in tax cuts. A dollar in tax cuts creates 10,700 jobs. And the reason why unemployment insurance creates more jobs is because people are spending all the dollars that they get from unemployment insurance, whereas someone who is employed, earning a dollar and getting that dollar back from tax credits, aren't spending the whole thing. They might be paying down debt. They may be putting it in savings accounts. They're doing other things with it. It doesn't go into the economy. And so that's one of the benefits that we have for unemployment insurance, is really stimulating the economy. Also shows that it can go, return on investment, it can be up as high as $2.15 per dollar invested. And why is that? Well, it's because when people buy their groceries, you're keeping the truck drivers, you're keeping the agriculture workers working, you're keeping the grocery stores going, you're putting gas in your car, you're paying for utilities, you're doing all those things that keeps the money flowing and keeps a person sustained in their homes. It also helps out in our real estate values as well, because the more people that aren't able to afford their homes, the more they're going to have to downgrade, which puts more homes up on the markets. Not only that, but we do want to keep those skilled workers here in Alaska. Alaska is one of the most seasonal states that we have. We're the most northern state. We have higher costs of living than any other state. And once we lose people, to take that big lift of moving out of the state of Alaska, it's really hard to get them to return back up here, especially when the lower 48 economy is doing so well. Somebody can go walk into Washington State right now, find a job, do really well, and then knowing that if they ever do lose their jobs in Washington State, that their unemployment insurance is going to be almost, you know, almost 70% more than what we have up here. So they're well taken care of. So that's some of the economic benefits of why unemployment insurance is beneficial to our economy. And just a couple of notes from what the Federal Reserve says about it. The Federal Reserve says that this is the best economic stimulus package that you can come up with. Second, upfront, over mass transit investments, infrastructure investments for mass transit. And the reason why it exceeds that is because a dollar is spent in the economy right away, whereas when you do infrastructure projects for mass transit, you have to design it, you have to plan it. It takes a while for that money to get into the economy. And so this is a direct effect. And then Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke once said that unemployment insurance benefits program has great taste and is less filling. It spurs growth and creates jobs.
Thank you very much, Representative Tuck. We do have one person who signed in from the Department of Labor, Clifford Napier, who's in Anchorage. Are there any questions for Clifford?
I do.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if you have other folks to testify, so this may come out.
There's some folks who are just calling in for public testimony.
Okay. My question would be two questions. One, if we had had a COLA in effect when we last increased the UI in 2009, what would that amount be today? Do we know?
Okay, and if I may, through the chair, Senator Meyer, we have Lyndon Weller with us from the Department of Labor. He said he can calculate that pretty quickly. But one of the things I want to say is that when we look at the automatic adjustments that we have with 36 other states, basically what this bill will do is take us up to the U.S. Department of Labor's recommendation of 50% of the replacement incomes for the average worker wages. And so if we had the automatic feature in there, we can tell you what that would be. It would be $510. But if we had just a single number and then inflation proof that number might be higher or lower. We don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And Senator Meyer, you were asking some questions.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if 510 is a good number. Had we had a COLA in place after we last increased it in 2009, I'm just curious just to see how that would relate to this number we're proposing today.
So for the record, my name is Lennon Weller, and I am both an economist and the functional actuary for the unemployment insurance system for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that actually very much is in line with roughly what we would see by direct calculation right now for calendar year 2018. I calculate out that the maximum weekly benefit amount would be $506. So that is very much so in line with what we would have calculated that out to be, very much in line with this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that how you arrived at the 510 number? This might be better for the sponsor.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. No, I'd be happy to answer that. I believe the 510 value was derived from what at the time when they were crafting the bill was the most recent annualized 50% of the average annual wage. I believe it was state fiscal year 2016 wages and employment, which was used to derive that $510.
Okay, now. Thank you.
Senator Meyer?
I do have a couple more questions, and if you're not the right person, then you can change seats too. Do we have a surplus or deficit in the trust fund right now, unemployment compensation?
So through the chair, Senator Meyer, right now we are actually very well positioned in terms of the financing of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. As of the end of February, which is the latest, most official balance, we had $442.7 million in there. And that corresponds to a 3.64% reserve ratio, which is probably the more important number. From a financing standpoint, we like to keep pre-recession between 3 and 3.3% of wages in reserves to handle increased benefit loads. So right now we have a we would consider a full solvency.
Okay, very good.
Senator Meyer?
In looking at the sponsor's statement, it looks like Alaska's one of only three states where the employers and the employees contribute. I'm not sure how I feel about that, if that's good or bad or indifferent, but what do the other 47 states do? Is it just all provided by the employer, I'm assuming?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes. Outside of those three states, us with Alaska being the sole state that actually on an ongoing continuing basis taxes employees for UI benefits, all the other remaining states do solely tax employers.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Meyer?
This, and this is an unfair question for you, but is the sponsor okay with that, or is that something you want to look at another day as far as the split between employer and employee, and maybe we should have the employer pay it all? I know that's easy for me to say. I'm not an employer.
I guess I'd be the sponsor.
And for the record, Representative Chris Tech, District 23. That's a very good question. I would like to make it so that we're like at least 47 other states, or even bringing it down to the other two states that have some sort of employee contribution, because nobody has the high ratio that we have. You know, we're 27% covered by the employee. That's very high, whereas the other ones are fractions of a percent. However, right now we see it very important that we put this money in the economy for those who are unemployed. So we didn't want to get hung up on too many fixes at one time. Right now, it's just basically bringing it up to the recommended level of the Department of Labor, and then also coming up with that automatic factor so we can not have to look at this, because really it's only been looked at once in 22 years.
Okay, thank you.
Now you can say you came to the committee looking for a bill and you got a chair. Senator Meyer, are you?
Know that now that it has a chair, I have no more questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Doesn't have a gavel.
Okay. Mike, I do have a question. So, when you look at the bill and the way it was introduced, the $510 per a week would apply to those highest wage earners. Could you explain for those who are listening in how this bill actually works in terms of the payout?
Sure, and Madam Chair, if you look at starting on page, let me find it here, page 7 of the bill, and basically these are a continuation of what's already in statutes, and for every $250 increase in weekly earnings, I'm sorry, annual earnings for an employee, it goes up $2 per week in the weekly benefit. And so that already is in statute, but we're just continuing it all up to the 510 number. And so if you look, you know, for someone who is making $42,000 on line 3 right there, they're going to be capped off at currently at 370. And anyone that's making more than that is still going to be capped off at $370. So someone that may be making double that, making $84,000 a year, they probably have more expenses. They probably have a higher mortgage. They may even have more children. So it's going to be harder for them to be able to sustain themselves until the next job comes around, when they're only getting half the benefit that somebody would be making at a full $42,000. So you really don't capture the full benefits until once you go over $42,000. And so we're bringing it up to the average income level, if you look on page 9, to where it's been calculated from 2016 at $59,500.
Thank you. And have you run any economic modeling to find out the impact that this bill would have on the fund itself?
For the chair, Senator Costello, yes, we've certainly run some economic modeling on cost impacts of this increase, at least out to 2024, which I believe should be included in any information you guys might have gotten before.
And that's Lennon. Just for those listening online, they might not be able to differentiate between the voices.
For the record, this is Lennon Weller. Senator Costello, we have run some modeling on the impacts to costs and then as a result of the trust fund on this increase in benefit costs, and we have run those out to at least through 2024.
Did you want to share some of that information with the committee?
Sure, absolutely, through the chair. What we're looking at for the next several years without this change is some pretty significantly low costs based on some economic factors that we've got going on with some potential for an increase in there. However, the main point being that our reserve ratio and trust fund balance continues to remain very solvent. And in fact, slightly above our target for quite a few years out. What this particular bill does is bring costs essentially back into like long-term goals with where financing of the system tends to be more reactive and functional. What we've seen in terms of cost increases on a individual employer basis. So if we look at some of the specifics, say for costs to an employer per employee making at the taxable wage base, which are the wages subject to the unemployment insurance tax, that we're looking at increases not beginning to go into effect until really for the average rate class out to 2021. Where we start to see cost increases, maximum cost increases per employee of $70 increasing to $139 in 2022, then to $222 in 2023, and falling back to a difference of $185 over our baseline cost expectations. This is, of course, at the average tax rate, so these would be tax classes 10 and 11.
Madam Chair, can I just add in one thing? There are some charts that might help following along that we added in your committee packet. So,
and Kendra, if you could state your name for the record.
Kendra Closter, staff to Representative Tuck. It might help when he's walking through some of this. I think there should be a number of charts in your packet, and so he's getting a lot of the numbers off what were included. So it might be helpful, I know, when talking through those numbers that you have in front of you.
Lennon, are those is that modeling inclusive of the inflation proofing that's in the bill? Could you point to where that is in the bill? Maybe Kendra.
So Senator Costello, with respect to inflation proofing, I'm not sure the financing of the system. It will respond in kind to cost. So in a sense, it doesn't necessarily inflation proof itself, but will, as ratios of wages in the economy continue to fluctuate. Maybe I misunderstood the question.
I think maybe you did. So my question is if the bill were to pass as written, would the highest change be to the 510 per week, or would that amount go up over time?
Good question. So through the chair, going out at least to 2024, we expect very little change in the average annual wage. And you can see that in we do have a column looking at the taxable wage base. And if we just follow it down, looking out to the next calendar year, we're projecting a taxable wage base of, or I'm sorry, so taxable wage base $38,200 going to $38,500, $38,700, $39,900, $39,100, $39,300. And this corresponds, of course, to the average annual wage in the economy throughout this period. As a result, we don't actually expect during this whole period the maximum weekly benefit amount to change. And this is reflected in the remaining 510 max being in place in that final column to the right through the entire period. We don't expect, you know, wages to change by any measurable level to be able to move that up from that point.
Could you explain on page 9, lines 13 through 17 in section 2?
Thank you. This is Representative Chris Tuck, District 23. Madam Chair, that's the automatic adjustment factor, but it's not based on a cost of living allowance. It's not based on a consumer price index. It's actually based on what the average income wage earner would be. So it's the average annual wages of Alaskans. And so what the Department of Labor was saying is that they don't expect that to increase. Wages are going to be stagnant for a while. Therefore, unemployment insurance benefits aren't going to go up either, because if all of a sudden we had a spike in the economy and then wages went up proportionally, then you would see unemployment insurance go up along with that, because it's basically factored on 50% of the average annual wage as recommended by Department of Labor. And that's how that's calculated, is in Section 2 there. And so they're going to be looking back at the previous year, recalculating it, and then forecasting it what it would be for the upcoming year. And then we have 36 other states that do that as well. Only one state does it below 50%. And I think they do it at 47%, but some states do it as high as 66% of the average annual wage.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. So I guess my question, I understand how that section works.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But thank you for the clarification. This is a new section of the bill, so currently this is not something that is adjusted in this manner. Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. So it's a static system. Thank you. Are there any other questions that committee members have? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. We'll now open this up for public testimony. Ryan Andrew in Anchorage calling on behalf of IBEW, Local 1547.
Yes, thank you for the record. This is Ryan Andrew with IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee for allowing me to speak today in favor of House Bill 142. As you know, Alaska's unemployment benefit amount hasn't seen an increase since 2009, quite a long time ago since we increased that. And as has been mentioned, some statistics that Alaska ranks 37th in the nation for maximum weekly benefit. But when you look at the wage replacement ratio, as was mentioned earlier, we are dead last in the country. So in Alaska, this is particularly important. Also, as has been mentioned, for Alaskan workers who are employed in industries such as construction, they rely on the unemployment benefits to carry them through the lean times of the winter when construction work isn't readily available. And when you couple that with Alaska's relatively high cost of living, $370 a week just is not enough to fill that void for those workers through the winter months. So an increase to the unemployment insurance would benefit both employees and employers. I think that's important to note, that it's going to be a direct benefit for employees, but a sort of an indirect benefit for employers, because as was mentioned by Representative Tuck earlier, with our current economic climate in Alaska, and taken with the fact that construction and growth on the west coast of the lower 48 states is booming right now, employers are finding it more and more difficult to retain their workforce that they've trained here in Alaska. I have spoken with personally some of our own workers who have relocated to parts of the West Coast and are intending to stay there for the indefinite future. So we're talking about, you know, an Alaskan worker who was trained here, who their family was here, relocated to the West Coast because of our economic climate. We, in our apprenticeship program in particular, we've invested between $20,000 and $30,000 in training that apprentice, and 4 to 5 years of training to go along with that. So it's really tough when we start losing those field workers to the lower 48. And like I mentioned, some of them are not planning on coming back. So an increase to this benefit would encourage those workers to stay here, even during the times of slow construction, like what we're experiencing now. Also, as has been mentioned, Alaska is one of only three states where the unemployment insurance cost is shared by the employee and the employer. I think that's important to point out as well, that this is a shared burden between the two parties. There have been a little bit of misinformation provided recently about House Bill 142, and just wanted to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak about the positive impact that it would have on hardworking Alaskan families. And thank you to the committee for your time today. I encourage you to support House Bill 142. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate you calling in. Next, Sergio Acuna, calling in from Anchorage.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sergio Acuna. I'm a construction worker for over 22 years here in the state, all over the state. I must add to that. I'm calling and I urge you to support House Bill 142, which would increase the maximum weekly benefits available under Alaska Unemployment Insurance Program. House Bill 142 will raise Alaska maximum weekly unemployment insurance benefits to $510. This much-needed increase will help unemployed workers and their families to make ends meet while they do, while they look for another job during those winter months. I must have to add, I am one of the lucky ones, one of the construction workers who are lucky enough to hold on to a full-time job now. But I'm speaking on behalf of those who out there who often don't have a voice to bring out to you guys, and they only have a voice within their family, which is they are suffering for not having enough to bear with the winter months. I would like to point the fact that the months of work in the state of Alaska, there are around 5 months of work, May through September. That's our season. Comes October, our workers start shaking and I start wondering, what are they going to do for work in this winter time? Please know there's 7 months of winter. They're more likely will be work available for them. Also, it's been almost in behalf of those who are suffering for low income, for unemployment, for those benefits, I urge the Senate and the chairman to move House Bill 142 from the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and hope you will vote in favor of the bill when it comes before the Senate. Thank you for your time. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you very much. Next, Doug Tansey with the Fairbanks Central Labor Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. For the record, Doug Tansey, President of the Fairbanks Central Labor Council. I don't want to belabor too many points that have already been brought up in hearing this bill. We certainly, as the Fairbanks Central Labor Council, does support advancement and approval of this bill. We also would like the committee to consider, beyond the economic factors, some of the social factors that come into play when families are stretched beyond their means to an extent that it can affect grades, it can affect nutrition, it can affect mental health. The hardworking folks of Alaska deserve a bill like House Bill 142, and we just like to lend our support to that and ask you to advance the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, Lake Williams from the Fairbanks Building Trades.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name for the record is Lake Williams. I'm the president of Fairbanks Building Trades and the district rep for the operating engineers in Fairbanks. I have already introduced a resolution on behalf of the Fairbanks Building Trades when it was in the House, and I have sent it to the committee, so I think it's already in the record, but I will give a copy to Carice here just in case. As a representative of Local 302 and Building Trades, we are in strong favor of this bill being passed by the Senate and sent to the governor. With small capital budgets and the working hours on the North Slope being significantly down, our members are relying more on UI benefits more than ever to help pay their mortgage and house and car payments, as well as providing food for the family until the next job opportunity presents itself. This year we had probably between 300 or 400 people on the out-of-work list hoping to go to the slope to find work, and the jobs just aren't available right now. And so people need something, otherwise they're going to look for something else. And we have another problem, due to the increase in competition by contractors based out of the lower 48, there's less of work available for our local contractors. And some of those signatory contractors are already experienced their skilled workforce taking jobs in other industries or moving out of state. And we most of the time don't see those workers come back. Sometimes those workers become these transient workers that we all complain about, where they just come back to Alaska, get a paycheck, and then they go back to their new state of residence and spend their money there. I think an increase in unemployment benefit will help curb this and let workers be able to pay their bills until the next job comes along. I would strongly urge the Senate to pass the bill and send it to the governor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll come into the room, Don Etheridge with Alaska AFL-CIO, followed by Barbara Huff-Tuckness with the Teamsters.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Name is Don Etheridge. I'm representative for the Alaska State AFL-CIO, and we are in strong support of HB 142 and would request that you move it on. Back in a previous life, I was the business agent for the laborers union here in the last downturn, and we had lost over 50% of our membership list moved either to Washington, Oregon, or Nevada at that time. And we had to start all over when the economy started coming back up with the training. And we spend millions of dollars of our members' monies to retrain them so that we can keep the workforce viable. And I think that passage of this bill will help try to keep some of those folks in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. Next, Barbara.
I'll move over by the mic. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness, Director of Government and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for hearing House Bill 142. I am not going to go through and reiterate all the testimony. I think the testimony has been excellent. Just a reminder that the unemployment insurance, like our health insurance, like our fire insurance, our home insurance, again, it's another opportunity to have a little bit of extra cushion out there if there happens to be these unexpected economic impacts out there that sometimes folks are not in a position to prepare for, or their savings nowhere can cover a total loss of work out there, forcing people to leave not only their community but the state as well. With respect to Senator Meyer's comment, I would, just on the record, I have never had a member complain about the contribution that they make towards the unemployment insurance, and I think it's a good thing that we're all employers and employees, myself included, actually jointly making that kind of contribution to a very, very important insurance opportunity or plan out there, and urge your support and passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Next, Anthony Ladd calling in from Anchorage.
Hello, Chairman. Thank you for allowing me to speak, and members of the committee. My name is Anthony Ladd, Ironworkers Local 751, and I'm calling in regards to House Bill 142 in support of it, and I'd like to speak on my own experience coming as a construction worker in Alaska. When to say that an ironworker's job is seasonal is kind of understated, and every year when the work would stop, you know, we'd have to file for unemployment. I could tell you from my own experience that having four kids, I would just get on the plane and fly down south and go to work. And it was a lot harder. Wasn't much money to support us on our unemployment. I urge you to increase it to higher and compare with the state wages. And I want to change gears. I'm going to tell you about, I'm also the training trust coordinator for Ironworkers Local 751. And when I get done with this conversation, I'll go back outside to teach these apprentices. And the idea that we spend so much money in training the workforce of Alaska, and then when they do get laid off in the long winters, they're going to do nothing but leave. And get that unemployment somewhere else. So once again, I want to just thank you and urge you to support 142.
Thank you, Anthony. Does anyone else online wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Oh okay. Please feel free to come forward. Just state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Rodney Hessen. I'm the president of Juneau and Vicinity Building and Trades Council. And we've already heard all the numbers about where Alaska ranks in comparison with other states. Basically, what I'd like to point out is that, Tony Ladd mentioned, apprenticeship efforts here in the state have been ongoing for years and years. But what we're up against now is the silver tsunami. People are retiring at tremendous rates. It seems to be accelerating every year. We're trying to stay ahead by training apprentices, but without the work, we cannot keep up. And then, so once we get these apprentices trained, and in our IBEW apprenticeship, it takes 5 years. There's a lot of effort that goes into training these apprentices, and then for them to up and leave once they can as journeymen, we may never see them again. So it's kind of a double impact, and I thought I'd share that aspect for you and the committee members today just to put it into a little better, deeper perspective why we need to keep our workers here in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you testifying. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Okay, is there anyone else online who wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none. Public testimony for House Bill 142 is now closed. Are there any comments or questions from committee members? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understood this bill in the beginning to be about sort of protecting the families and the people who are temporarily out of work. But my understanding of that has broadened to realize what happens if they can't stay here and we lose them forever. And anybody who's tried to find an electrician to do, you know, a day's work or something, it's very difficult because they're so busy because they don't have enough of them. So it has a broader impact, too.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I don't know if it would be okay to, I'd like to find out how unemployment works a little bit more, like, and maybe the commissioner or somebody or even the sponsor could help me. I don't know. I think you have to work two continuous quarters in order to be eligible. So I don't know if that would include some of our seasonal jobs like tourism, fishing, and even construction probably doesn't always work two continuous quarters. So,
Lennon, would you like to come forward and respond to that question? Thank you for the question, Senator Meyer, and welcome back, Representative Tuck.
Okay, thank you.
Lennon Weller here, economist for the Department of Labor. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, it is correct that you are required to work in multiple quarters in order to be potentially eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. You have to have at least $100 in a quarter outside of your primary quarter of earnings. For example, if you were highly seasonal and you had nearly all of your earnings in one quarter alone of the year, you'd need to at least have very few earnings, $100 outside of that quarter in order to qualify. But in terms of the amount that you would qualify for, what we use is what we refer to as your base period wages, which is the first four of the most recent five completed calendar quarters. So that is what would be used to assess your benefit amount. However, depending upon the ratio of your wages, how seasonal, so to speak, they are, that also impacts duration, how long you can file for as well. If that answers.
Okay. Senator Meyer?
No, I think I'm confused, but thank you for trying to explain it to me. So I guess my question would be, like, some of these folks come up from out of state or even out of the country to work in the seafood processing plants throughout the summer. And they're here legally to work, but would they still also get unemployment after, say, September, October, whenever they go back?
So through the chair, Senator Meyer, great question. As long as they met the strict requirements in terms of having enough qualifying wages, that's at least, I should have mentioned, $2,500 at least in wages, and, of course, had at least some wages outside of one quarter, as long as they remained within the country and also met the other requirements of work searches, being able and available for work, and those sorts of things, that yes, they could technically qualify and receive benefits.
Okay.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Lennon. So, Len, let me ask you one more question. Because you're an economist, right? And,
yes.
You know, kind of like lawyers, you get two economists and you can get two different answers, right?
So they say.
Yeah, that's good. Don't admit to that. So we have letters here from small businesses that are opposed to this, and I was just thinking, if indeed increasing this would be healthy for the economy, why would they be opposed to this?
Through the chair, that's a very good question. Any time you increase costs, increase benefit amounts, which then, of course, do increase more costs on the system, there's going to be corresponding responses in terms of tax rates, and it's understandable that businesses would be concerned about those increased liabilities, being able to function in the economy, remaining profitable, and those sorts of things. I think it's important, though, to keep in mind that while all of the analysis that we've looked at and the costs in terms of the tax rates, that everything has been done at the average rate classes, and it's important to keep in mind that we do, in fact, experience rate employers in addition to as a secondary post calculation of total costs and the average tax rate. So for those employers that have relatively stable payrolls, their tax rates are going to reflect that stability in their payroll, and in fact will receive a rate much lower than on average, so to speak, that we're talking about here. So while it's certainly understandable that businesses would be concerned about increased costs and then therefore increase payroll taxes, that it's also important to keep in mind that there is parity set up within the unemployment insurance financing system, so that as long as you as a small business have a stable payroll, you're likely to receive a reduced rate as a result of that. So it should proportionally affect employers that have more experience with the program and so on.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Meyer, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota, and I'm just going to quote, if you don't mind, says here, despite years of research, the economic effects of unemployment benefits are poorly understood. While intuition might suggest that providing financial aid to people who lose their jobs would discourage them from seeking new jobs, recent research has found that extending benefits has little effect at the individual level. And one of the reasons why is there's low opportunity costs, meaning that when you go from unemployed to employed, you don't give up a whole lot. There's not any risk there. You're willing to give up that unemployment insurance to get full employment. Unlike if you were going to open up a restaurant. If you're going to open up a restaurant, there's high opportunity costs there. And so it might prevent somebody from wanting to get into the restaurant business because of those high opportunity costs. And, of course, the solution to unemployment is going to be creating new jobs. And the Federal Reserve also says that unemployment insurance adds to the overall demand and raises employment over what otherwise would have been if you did not have any type of unemployment insurance at all. And that's during those periods of economic weaknesses that you keep that money going and keep it stimulated. So why are some, I think your question was, is why are some of the business groups opposing it? I think it's because of that misunderstanding and how it really does affect the economy. Some people look at it as just being paying people to sit at home, but that hasn't been the case.
Okay. Something for me to ponder, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm just thinking, for example, in Alaska, one of our largest employers is the oil industry, and I don't know how raising the UI is going to help them become more profitable.
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Meyer, that's a very good question, because the oil industry isn't dependent on Alaska's economy. They're more dependent on having access to those resources. They're more of a global economy, so you're right. It's the small independent business people that rely on the economy of Alaska for their goods and services and for their profits and everything else. But your point is very well spoken, because it really doesn't help them at all. Unless they want to maintain their workforce here in Alaska, and knowing that, you know, they're not going to be building ice roads in the summer months, but they want to be able to maintain those people, or at least help them transition to other jobs so they can grab them back, then that would be a benefit.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And then, you know, if that industry is healthy, then they're going to hire support industries like the independent folks that, to work for them. And like you said, you want to keep them trained. You don't want to lose them once they're trained. Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So with that, thank you, Representative Tuck, and members from the department who are here. Appreciate it. We will go ahead and set this bill aside. Our next committee meeting is Thursday at 1:30. We are hoping to have a committee substitute for House Bill 170, and then we will have bills previously heard. So with that.
What is 170 again?
That is the, I can give you the title later. Natasha, do you have the title to House Bill 170? Yes, it's the update to the Securities Act, one that Kevin Anselm has been working on past her retirement.
All right. Thank you.
So with that, we are adjourned.